Well, hello everyone. Welcome to Struggle Session. I'm Leslie Lee III.
And I'm Emma Bowers.
And Jack is not joining us today. He is getting a little holiday vacation from this episode, from this movie, really, because we are review. And I hope we are putting this episode out fast enough in time to spare a lot of you from watching this as well. But we do have a very, very special guest. And I'm a little bit ashamed to have them on for such a lowly, unintellectual thing, because this is one of the most intellectual, intelligent people that I've ever encountered as a writer, as a scholar, as a critic. Q Anthony from the Drop Squad podcast, as well as the contributing editor to McLean's, and the one of the founders of Resistance Noir. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate that. And that's, oh, geez, man, you were just laid it on thick there. You're making me blush.
Well, you know, I'm it's very true. You have such a long litany of, you know, scholarship and work, and you're always putting in the work online and off. But I saw you made the mistake of tweeting about this movie, and I was like, I have to have you on for this because I want to really know. And plus, it's an easier show for me because you can, like, rip this thing to shreds. And Emma as well, I saw that you were tweeting about it, and I was like, yeah, I can put this together, you know. I can get a little bit of content out of this horrible experience at the very least. So today we are talking about Wonder Woman 84, the sequel to Patty Jenkins's Wonder Woman, taking place in the DC Extended Universe. It stars Gal Gadot, as well as Chris Pine, Kristen Wiig, Pedro Pascal, Robin Wright, and Connie Nielsen make brief appearances as well. And you know, this is the sequel to the first Wonder Woman movie. And just before we dive into this one, what did all of y'all think about the first one?
I guess, like, for me with, like, superhero movies, I have, like, kind of a baseline, like, is it watchable? And I remember, like, to some extent enjoying Wonder Woman, but I should mention, sometimes when I say I enjoy something, it doesn't really mean it's good or it can't hold up, you know, or, like, it's not immune to scrutiny or anything. I didn't hate it the way some people did, and I saw some people just absolutely rip into it, but I was like, it's fine, you know, it is a movie about Wonder Woman. I was actually, like, kind of going in expecting it from this one, and I was like, oh no, it's not even watchable.
Yeah, I thought the first film was, I expected silly and goofy in the first place. Like, that's kind of the direction that the DCEU has kind of taken after the, you know, everyone complained about the grim dark in Batman versus Superman. So it seemed like their film offerings after that were just, like, sort of silly and campy. And that's what I thought I was going to get from the first Wonder Woman movie. It was really silly, but I thought it was all right. Just, there was some scenes of some incredibly cringeworthy acting going on. And I know that a lot of people had concerns about the lead actress, Gal Gadot, but I try to, you know, separate, like, a popcorn movie going experience from the subtext therein. And you can always talk about the subtext afterwards, but because I'm a family man, I just try to enjoy stuff. Otherwise, I just walk around making, like, my fiance miserable and having my children, like, have a grumpy, nothing but, like, a grumpy face to grow up around. So you have to at least, like, put on airs. But this film, it was just me and my fiance watching it last night. And, oh my God, I try to turn off critical brain when I watch movies and try to enjoy them as much as I can, if only for my fiance's sake, because, again, I don't want her around somebody who's just, like, grouchy all the time. But the moment the movie was over, like, everything just started cycling through my head. Like, all of what I had just watched, everything that I had, like, barely suppressed throughout the entire film just broke through the dam. And I was supposed to be off of social media until after the holidays. And I was like, no, fuck this. I can't do this anymore. I can't take it. So I logged on and started tweeting last night. Yeah, and I don't know, the whole, like, from beginning to end, especially, like, the last two acts of the movie, which, by the way, the movie, how long was, the movie is longer than some, like, some classic
real
movies. Like, I'm pretty sure it's longer than the fucking Godfather. Right? It was a long ass movie,
two and a half hours.
Terrible for 2/3 of it. Jesus Christ! The entire second and third act were absolute trash. Just the most unwatchable shit, and full of these like Orientalist stereotypes. And anyway, we can get into it. I was so like infuriated by what I had just put myself through that I had to log in and tweet about it, and then here we are.
Yeah. I like what you say, Q, where it's like it kind of came crashing down, because I had the same thing, and I have the same also deal with my partner where I'm like, I don't want to come in and just utterly ruin his experience by making Gal Gadot war crime jokes the entire time. You know, we're going to have a positive Christmas, and we're going to sit down and watch the Wonder Woman movie together.
That's why we go on Twitter and make Gal Gadot war crime jokes.
Yes.
Same thing. I'm watching, and the same thing, and it kind of finished, and I was just like, what the? It was like Tetris. Everything had stacked up.
And yeah, so, I mean, this 1984, I really did not like the first Wonder Woman movie. But as you said, Emma, it was kind of like baseline good enough for a superhero movie. Like, and it seemed kind of like effortlessly so. This was Patty Jenkins's second major feature after Monster, which she had directed like, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And she spent a lot of time in TV, and then she's given, you know, this really big budget superhero blockbuster. And I don't like the movie, but for the most part, I think it was a very competently made blockbuster film, even if it's boring. I don't really find it. And Gal Gadot is like not that great an actress, and she's much worse in this one. But for the most part, the first one just felt like, okay, they had their shit together and they put out what they needed to put out. And it made a bunch of money, and that I feel like most people felt like they got their money's worth. This one, though, with 6 extra goddamn months to polish, finish, change up stuff, maybe do a reshoot or two, because this movie was supposed to come out in like June or July. You have been seeing advertisements for it. If you had ordered from Dairy Queen in the past few months, you have been getting like Wonder Woman merch. Like all of that has been going on for months and months and months. And in that time, I would have expected them to make this film as good as possible, but it feels like just a completely tonal mess. The script makes no sense whatsoever. You will not know what's going on in this movie. It feels like a flashback to the older style of superhero movies where it would just be written by, you know, just like one coked up guy who barely has read the comic books and just puts whatever in the movie, you know, like the Richard Donner stuff or the Tim Burton superhero movies. But it's not the clean, polished superhero film that we're used to getting. And, you know, sometimes that sort of sloppiness can be enjoyable. A lot of times it's a lot more enjoyable than the Disney approved version, but in this one it's just boring, dull, confusing, and just baffling. So many times I was just watching this movie and shocked that this is what they decided was a good idea.
The worst thing so far on HBO Max, and we watched Congo the other night for our other podcast.
Oh no.
Yeah, speaking of very a white guy wrote this and did not have a sensitivity reader on board.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of like the old 1980s Dino De Laurentiis type movies, where I guess that was actually the look that they were going for. But from the very beginning, I was like, okay, I get the like aesthetic, and they were just like throwing 1980s all in your face, like with people's like everything from like the workout attire to the way that like professional people dressed to
like the font. Woman,
yes.
Yeah.
Unreadable font.
unreadable 1980s neon font. Like everything was just like so atrociously like tacky. But the from the very beginning, you know, some weird stuff happens. Like a car comes zooming out of nowhere. There's a couple of guys that are taking a joyride in what looked like, I'm pretty sure it was a Pontiac Firebird, but or at least it was a Firebird. And they almost ran over this this lady who was jogging and crossing the street, and Wonder Woman kicks the vehicle, And the vehicle, like, so she kicks it out of the way so that it doesn't hit this this jogger pedestrian. And it spins into the middle of the road. Doesn't hit anybody in oncoming traffic. Doesn't, like, fly to the other side of the road. It's just whatever. But the car didn't have, a scratch on it after she just, like, kicked it into doing a 720. The vehicle was in perfect condition, and the occupants were completely fine. And I thought to myself, okay, this is gonna be some interesting shit. And it was just like that, where, like, nothing that actually happens in the movie has a consequence to anything else that happens in the movie, unless it's a bad guy doing it. Like, there's no broader implications for what Wonder Woman does to anybody throughout the entire film. Like, nobody's actually, like, harmed in the process. And we can get into this a little bit later, but it's like, Wonder Woman is not only a superhero, she's also a superhero incapable of harming other people. And that's just not Wonder Woman from the comics.
What I noticed, and I like that you bring this up, because the very beginning is like baby Diana on, like, you know, Amazon Island, and she competes in their little, like, I guess Amazon version of American Gladiators. And she almost is about to win, but she's cheated. And her aunt and her mom basically are like, no, you cheated, you're disqualified. And she's like, you know, 10. So she has like an absolute fit. And they're just like, this is just how this is. And I remember liking that scene, because I was like, oh, I like that they're going to address perhaps, you know, she's not infallible. And perhaps, you know, there are still things she has to work on. But no, it's literally just, you have to tell the truth. And then that comes in later, and it is the most bullshit baby brained, like, we're talking, this is like an episode of Peppa Pig. And it is so wild for me, because it is set in 1984. And I remember when they announced that, I was like, oh boy, like, Wonder Woman's gonna battle the evil communists. And then when I saw the original trailer, I was like, oh, this is gonna be, to be fair, like a capitalist comment upon, you know, the absolute, like, rampantness of, like, neocapitalism's boom in the 80s. And for being in 1984, it isn't about anything. It doesn't have any sort of commentary about that, like, timeline, even kind of half-assed, or like, well, capitalism's bad in the wrong hands or some, there's nothing. And it takes place in this really interesting time, and they're not interested in saying anything except for, like, oh, there's a mall, because that's something in the 80s. You remember leotards and like leg warmers? And they don't do anything with it, and it's so frustrating.
No, it is actually about something, but I think what it is that it's about Patty Jenkins' formative years and how everything was just great in the 1980s. And I find this happens a lot with, like, even with Stranger Things, for example, and other shows that are not just, like, taking place in the 1980s, but very deliberately and very, like, in-your-face 1980s. And what it seems to be is, like, people who are of that, like, the Gen X age and the late boomer age are just trying to recapture the feelings of their youth by telling us the 1980s were the best time period that ever existed. And it's like, you could probably feel that way because, A, if you're a late boomer, you feel that way because you don't want to interrogate how your lifestyle was funded on the immiseration of the third world, or B, you weren't old enough to really process why everything around you seemed to be good, and you've never really cared to interrogate that. And in a time period now when we're very, very conscious about U.S. imperialism and Western imperialism and what it means for the global South, you would like for us to take our attention away from all these horrible things that are happening and saying, yeah, but what if you could just return to a time when everything was just okay and we agreed with each other, maybe disagreed with on some things politically, but agreed that we were Americans UK people or Canadian people or whatever. And the whole idea is to make you, like, lull yourself back to sleep.
Yeah, and it's especially apparent because this is kind of like a time-traveling story, too, for Steve Trevor. So the first Wonder Woman, she's a fish out of water because comes from this paradise island that's, like, vaguely ancient Greek, but also, like, has some modern stuff, too. And she comes to modern, you know, to the World War One era, UK and Europe, and she's just absolutely horrified by all the violence and the misery that's going on, right? In this one, you have the fish out of the water is Steve Trevor, who was a World War One like spy and fighter pilot for the United States, who fell in love with Wonder Woman, and then he dies, and then his soul is transported to 1984, where Diana is now living in Washington D.C. And his observations of the modern world, of 1984, that version of the modern world at that time is just wow, this is all like really cool and stuff, like you got like fast trains and like a subway and shit. Like usually these fish out of war tales, they're supposed to be like some sort of critique or analysis of the era of the time that this person is going into. But Steve Trevor, even coming from, you know, like the 1940s, has really nothing to say about 1984. And certainly the movie, as you were both saying, doesn't really say anything about 1984 other than, wow, it was like pretty cool. But there was also like in the background, like we were worried about nuclear weapons or something like that. It doesn't really address like what the era is, and it's baffling why it was even set in 1984. It could have been set right now.
It's been bugging the shit out of me because so in the first Wonder Woman movie, it kind of is just contemporary setting Wonder Woman, and Gal Gadot is like, once I was I lived on an island, and I can't do her accents. It just sounds like she's reading cue cards.
Please keep doing it.
I live on an island, and then something happened to me, and then I became Wonder Woman, and I met Steve, and then Steve died. And this is like contemporary. This is taking place around the same time Batman v Superman's happening. So for me, it's just really weird. It's not like, oh, and then Steve came back briefly in the 80s. He took over a body of another man. We had sex multiple times using this body. And then he died again. And it is something, and a couple other people brought this up, but it's just really, here's the thing. It is a baby superhero movie. You don't need to explain like why Steve's back. He's back because the magic rock wished him back. But they have this whole thing where he's possessed the body of another man, and it never is a problem. No one's concerned. He doesn't have like any friends or family checking in on him. Like the world goes to shit. Did he just like completely black out? Just like what happened in the past week? Like this poor guy.
I was thinking to myself, like, is he conscious during all of this? Like, is he like feel his body and
God,
watch his body
like,
being
out.
Manipulated and controlled? Yeah, imagine him being like a prisoner in your own body while
the
this like
sunken place while Gal Gadot bangs you.
Now, oh God, let me not get canceled by saying what I want to say next. But all I'm going to say is that is like the closest to an acceptable rape fantasy that I think the DCEU has ever come to.
This is going to be a premium episode. This is premium. This is on the premium feed now.
No, what I'm trying to say is it's very clear that this guy's Steve's consciousness comes back into this other guy's body, and Wonder Woman or Diana Prince has no ethical qualms whatsoever with using this man's body to fulfill like her wish of having her man back. Which, on top of that, I was actually really upset. I only intended to get on Twitter and tweet one smarmy thing, and then it spiraled off into something else because the dam broke. But I said. I cannot wait, because my daughters are less than 3 years old right now. I'm like, I cannot wait until I can show them this movie so that I can tell them if they get one wish and one only, the thing that they should wish for, like the very, very tippity top wish that they should ever wish for, is for a man. Out of anything in the world that you can have, you should wish for a man, because this is important. And the way that the man comes back into her life is that she like doesn't even get her man back. She gets a man with her man's consciousness in it. So this guy is basically just a fucking meat puppet for a solid week, putting himself in mortal danger and like having sex with a total stranger, not of his own accord. That is fucking scary. And there's no moral lesson or implication here whatsoever, despite, as Emma mentioned, the opening scene. It was just frightening to me.
Can we also talk about how, like, she's fucking Wonder Woman. She's Wonder Woman, and she's played by this fucking Israeli supermodel, and she's like, I will never love again. I'm like, what the fuck?
Really?
No one? Like, I was saying this, but I was like, Really? You're telling me that you've lived like for almost a century in this fucking world, and the only guy you ever wanted to like be with was from a time where women couldn't even legally vote? Couldn't like meet like one sensitive like beatnik or something?
Hey, yo, she knew this motherfucker for like 2.5 weeks. Yeah. So she became a 70-year war widow out of knowing some guy for a couple of weeks. They shared, what, like a passionate kiss in the movie? And that was it. They had one tender moment, and then she decided to be a widow. Not even just like never love again. She doesn't do anything. She doesn't go out, because when she takes Kristen Wiig's character, who later becomes the cheetah, takes her out to lunch, you know, and she's at, Kristen Wiig asks her, So what do you do? Do you ever get out? You seem like you'd be really popular. And she's like, no, I don't do anything. I just stay home and I look at my walls. And it's like, but like losing somebody doesn't mean you don't have a social life. Okay, I was actually just talking to my fiance before I came down to record with you. And I was talking to her about that scene. I was like, it didn't make any sense to me. She's like, well, you know, my father passed away. And my mom never remarried. I'm like, yeah, but how long were they together? She says, like 20 years. I'm like, yeah, she knows this motherfucker for 2 weeks. And your mom has a social life. She knows people. She has friends. She watches television. She engages in educational pursuits. And especially like now that she's got an empty nest, she's like going off and doing her own thing. She's living her best life. What did Gal Gadot do besides work in a museum and then go home and stare at her like she doesn't watch TV. What she does is watch security cameras in a hidden room in her apartment next to this armor that only gets explained conveniently in the third act. But we can always come back to that. I'm like, it makes no sense for anybody to live this way.
I before we get off this, I just want to ask both of you. I asked this on our first episode when we talked about the first film. But I just want to ask both of you, how old is Wonder Woman in this movie?
Huh.
How old is she in this movie?
I apologize. It's been a while since I'm not super, super in tune to Wonder Woman lore, except that it was some dude's S&M fantasy, which I think would have been a better movie. But it, on the island, it feels like they don't age or something.
Yes. So if you go back and watch the first movie, we see her young, right? We see her as a baby. We see her grow up. And then the day she meets Steve Trevor is like the day that she graduates and becomes a full-fledged Amazon, right? So I'm asking the question, and she was born when the Greek gods died, and she meets Steve Trevor on her graduation day. How old is she actually supposed to be?
I'm pretty sure Patty Jenkins had said that she was like centuries old by the time the first movie begins. Like she's actually quite old.
So on that level, is the relationship with Steve Trevor from the beginning a significantly problematic age gap? Before we even get into the body consent issue.
Well, how old is Steve?
Oh, wait, Steve is like, like 30?
He's okay, in his late 30s. Like, I got to put this in. So me and Chris Pine are age twins. Like, he was born on the same exact day as me. So okay. At the time that movie came out, yeah, I'm pretty sure he was like 37. So if Steve Trevor is the same age as Chris Pine, and at the time that movie came out, Chris Pine was 37, that's got to mean there's a solid like 760-odd year age gap.
My thing I think it's okay. Like, he's not like, you know, 18. He's clear like world weary and stuff. I trust him to make decisions and make the proper decisions and not be like coerced or manipulated by this like 1,000-year-old like Amazon goddess.
Yeah, well, that's another thing. She's literally not a human being. She is a goddess, which they don't mention in this movie for some reason. It was like the whole point of the first movie was revealing the fact that, oh, actually you're half of a Greek, you're half Greek god, you're the daughter of Zeus, that's why you're more powerful than all the other Amazons. But in this movie, like, I don't, they mention like, oh, this crystal that's causing all these problems came from one of the gods, but they never, like, none of the gods show up. She doesn't talk about what happened to the gods, since like it's all just like not even considered. And that's very strange, because the movie is so long. They clearly could have had, like, you know, something about the Olympians in this.
Yeah, what was also kind of strange to me was that so she's the daughter of Zeus, and she reads. Oh, we haven't even really gotten into like the whole wish stone yet, but like the MacGuffin in the movie is this this device where after it's been mostly destroyed, Diana was able to read inscription on the inside of it, and she said it's in the language of the gods, and she was so shocked that she dropped it immediately. But yeah, you're right. There's no investigation. There's no like backstory to the creation of this thing by the gods whatsoever. And her powers begin to slowly become. I shouldn't even say slowly become removed, because they like kind of pop in where necessary and then pop out where they need to like drive the plot forward. But her powers are like fluctuating in this film, and they never actually talk about like why it is that Diana is just like so immensely powerful and so capable that she's like able to cheat her way through, I guess, like Amazonian gladiators as a 10 or 12 or 13 year old. But you know, her battle with one of the baddies in the movie, when her powers are restored, she's on like equal footing. It's like, so if you were on equal footing in the first fight, like you were on just underneath equal footing, but then you get your full range of powers back and you're basically like going blow for blow, how the fuck is it that you're the daughter of a goddess? Like it's just so inconsistent.
You know, I almost forgave that, because by that time something was actually happening in the movie. I'm like, okay, finally we have Cheetah. There's a big fight scene with Kristen Wiig before she actually transforms into Cheetah, and like her outfit is like kind of cool and stuff, but it's like not a full-fledged superhero fight. I don't know why we needed to wait till the third act to get like the villain to show up, but It's kind of unfair to really say Kristen Wiig is the villain, or even that Wonder Woman's Gal Gadot is the main character, because really this movie is about Pedro Pascal's Maxwell Lord as like and it's so strange, because like he's the only one really with any kind of like arc or like reason for living or being in the movie or any kind of motivation, and his story is kind of interesting and sweet, but like you could have called this movie Maxwell Lord, cut out like half of the like Steve Trevor Gal Gadot stuff, and this would probably be a lot much more enjoyable movie.
He also, I think, is the one the most like 80s in a good way. Like, it's actually trying to say something, I think, a little bit interesting about that world, which was just this complete, like, utter, like, you know, unchecked level of just, you know, like, complete and utter, like, deregulation.
Yeah, and here's he's like a Patrick Bateman, yeah, Donald Trump type figure.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. And then, like, everything else, it's just a mess, and there's too much stuff going on, and I don't know. Also just made me laugh because like Pedro Pascal is a very handsome man, and they're just trying to like, they're just trying so hard to sleaze him up. It's like,
yes.
How do we make him look unattractive?
Yeah. For him to like bring himself down to the base level that the character required, Pedro Pascal just doesn't have it in his system. What also bugged me was that I wonder if they changed his power set, that is Maxwell Lord's powers, because it comes too close to Kilgrave from the Jessica Jones show. That is, Maxwell Lord in the comics has the ability to persuade people. So like he can sort of like give people a psychic nudge. He can't control them the way that Kilgrave could. Like Kilgrave would just say a thing and somebody would have to do it because they were under his power. But Lord, what made him such an insidious character and why people hated him so much is because he got people to do the thing that they subconsciously didn't really want to do. So after they were released from his power, they still had to live with the guilt that whatever evil action that they took was something that they kind of wanted in the first place, which to me made him an interesting character. But in this film, it's just like hammed up to such an absurd degree that all he does is just like go around granting people wishes. So basically he's just like a human monkey's paw. That is, yes, he'll fulfill a wish, like somebody will wish for something, and he'll say granted, but then he'll take something away from them that they weren't even aware of, which I could have made for an interesting dynamic or an interesting plot, but it was completely absurd.
Yeah, like there's the pieces here of a pretty, you know, interesting, like, kind of silly 90s style superhero movie. I like the monkey's paw thing where he gets to decide what's the takeaway. That was kind of clever when I started to figure it out. Like, there was a couple of moments in this movie where I actually like, oh, that's kind of a good idea. But then they're all drowned out by all the bad ideas that and completely incomprehensible ones that just, like, the film is just, it feels so broken, just fundamentally broken. Like, for, like, we talked about Maxwell Lord, he gets a lot of screen time. We get to find out about his son, and basically the end of the movie is like him, he tries to destroy the world. Basically, he is supposed to be ushering in Armageddon, but the end of the film is actually that he, once he's able to realize that reconnecting with his son is more important than being rich and powerful, basically everything goes back to normal, more or less. And the movie is over, and like, he doesn't even like go to jail or anything. I feel you can't send somebody in jail for like magical crimes yet. There probably wouldn't be that legislation yet. But I do think that was kind of like, there's a kernel of an interesting story there, but it just gets too big and too out of hand, and becomes just really confusing. Like, what is actually happening? What the stakes are? Why? And they spend so much time also on the side story of like Trevor and Godot. And as we already said, like, it's already like a weird relationship, but they have no chemistry whatsoever, the two actors.
And it's so frustrating because I don't know, Chris Pine to me, like, out of the Chris quartet, he's the good
Chris.
Yeah. And he's good in this, you know, he's fine. He's likable. He's handsome. You know, he's very charming. And it's just weird to see him in this movie. Like, because it's just like he's there and there's no, like you said, like there's no real chemistry or connection. Him even in the, like he was saying in the fish out of water thing, like there should be a lot of like antics. There should be like him trying to figure out how a microwave works and, you know, get scared by a TV and, you know, maybe make a slightly, you know, problematic, you know, comment about these social improvements that have happened, even in a good natured level. And instead he's just like this. He says that he's like, oh, this place is amazing. But like, how? What? What is it? He's like, wow, I love deregulation. Like, you know, let's say it.
Yeah, you're right that I'm pretty sure the anti-Zatanna acts hadn't been enacted in Congress by the time this film takes place in the DCEU. But they're, the way that they sort of introduce the monkey's paw, I thought was really interesting. Like, so one of the background characters, you know, says that he wishes that he had a coffee, and then immediately one of his coworkers happens to be strolling in and says, oh, hey, I've got an extra coffee. Anybody want one? So I was like, okay, this is kind of clever. Like, it doesn't just materialize out of nowhere. It kind of seems like a coincidence. Like, somebody could wish for something, and then something just kind of shows up, and it's like, oh, okay, well, that's pretty cool that would happen. But, you know, at first, it doesn't seem like the things that happen are a direct consequence of people's wishes. But then what happens with it is just so, like, lopsided and lackadaisical. Like, it kind of seemed, for example, that when Barbara Minerva says that she wishes she was like Diana Prince, you know, and she says that because Diana saved her from street harassment and a possible rape, that she develops these powers slowly, but also at the same time, Diana is losing her powers after she had mentally wished for Steve to come back. So I was like, oh, are these two linked? Like, is Barbara getting stronger because Diana is getting weaker, or what's happening here? And it's only later that you really find out, oh, so Diana is losing her powers, or her powers are fluctuating because she wished for Steve to come back. But the way that the power loss is handled, it's so inconsistent. It's like, but why didn't the stone take away Diana's powers altogether? That would have been a pretty interesting movie to see how she like navigates this like threat to, you know, like global annihilation without any powers at all. But that's not what they did.
That's cool. We could have had a Superman 2 scene where she gets the shit kicked out of her in a diner.
Yeah, Wonder Woman does need one scene where she like this was supposed to be the movie where she kind of shows her vulnerability and weakness, but she gets shot a couple of times, but she mostly just shrugs it off, right? And she doesn't have to overcome or beat anybody while she doesn't have her powers. She mostly just survives. And then, usually in these movies, if you lose your powers, you still have to win one fight without them, but they don't really give her the opportunity to do that. Instead, and it's just so bizarre that this is supposed to be the feminist movie. She just spends the whole movie crying about not having Chris Pine, and then being happy because she has Chris Pine, and then being sad because she has to get rid of Chris Pine. And it's just her entire world revolves around this dude. I'm like, we love the guy, we love Chris Pine, but Wonder Woman should have more going on than just this.
Yeah, and it's like, I don't know, Wonder Woman's done a lot for herself. I mean, I know she doesn't have that social life, but it's like, she's head curator at the fucking Smithsonian. That in itself is kind of interesting. Did we need to bring back Chris Pine?
I guess we had to, because he was the biggest bit of life in the first one. I think it would be, even though they did kill him off, I think they maybe had to bring him back in some capacity, but it should have been and it shouldn't have been that Wonder Woman was hung up on him this whole time. It should have been she saw something that reminded her of him that day, and then she, I wish I could see him again, and it just was a coincidence that the Wishing Rock was there, right? You could have done it where that she, just on this day, she missed him. Instead, we're supposed to believe that she spent the past 60-70 years, every single day of every moment pining for him, and it just seems really sad and pathetic more than any sort of, it could have even been a fun thing, oh my god, my old boyfriend is back, wow, I can't believe it. But instead it's just this really dour thing where it's finally the only man I could ever love is back, but I know deep in my heart I'll have to lose him again. And it's just, it's no fun, and it's just, is really just quite sexist and ridiculous too.
Yeah, another thing was how they handle I don't know exactly what you would call it, but rather than show you a thing, they just tell you that this is true, right? So the way that they handle exposition was just so okay. So for example, I hate getting stuck hung up on the scene, but I kind of feel like the scene where Diana and Barbara go out to lunch is where things begin to fall apart, where Barbara asks her, hey, would you like to go out to lunch? And Diana's like, no, I'm pretty busy. You're not going to have time for lunch. And then, at the end of their conversation, she's like, hey, you know what? Let's go out for an early dinner. But I'm like, I thought you two just got into work. And are you going out for early dinner? What was the time skip here? So now they're out for dinner at this restaurant or whatever. And they didn't even show Diana and Barbara having a conversation where Barbara said something funny or charming.
Yes,
and Diana
I was
like,
thinking
ha,
the same
ha, ha, this
thing.
Is really funny. No, they skipped right to Diana laughing oh, ha, 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 you're so funny. I can't believe you're so funny. I'm like, but what did she say? Because right after you finish saying you're really funny, then Barbara goes back to being weird and fucking awkward and not being able to say, not being able to get through a sentence. So, why can't you just show me that this person is charming and witty underneath all of that awkwardness? They don't want to do that. And then when Barbara gets her power, she wishes that she was like Diana, and she could have had a change in attitude, or perhaps had an insight about something that she didn't before, and she's able to charm her coworkers because she says stuff or she changes her appearance in subtle ways. No, she basically falls asleep in her office. Her hair is a complete, if you've ever fallen asleep in a place that you weren't supposed to fall asleep in and then have to go to work, and I'm not going to elaborate further than that, right afterwards, you know that A, you're not going to look your best whatsoever, no matter how much you arrange your hair. B, people are going to notice that you're wearing the same clothes. Even if you take off one garment, the most visible thing about you is going to be your shirt. If you're wearing the same shirt to work 2 days in a row, people are going to notice that. So she leaves her office. Nobody notices that she's wearing the exact same shirt and the same leggings that she was the previous day. She doesn't say anything to people that was any different the way that she would communicate with them before, but everyone's like, oh, hey, Barbara. Oh my gosh, Barbara. Hey, looking good, girl. And it's like, okay, first of all, she hasn't brushed her teeth, so I know you're lying. And second of all, nothing about her appearance or attitude or anything has changed. You're just magically believing that this is what is charming and witty and attractive now because the plot requires you to. And I thought, that's like a first draft mistake. How did you even get to a finished product with this?
Yeah, there's so much of that. I really part of the problem is that they never show why Diana Prince is cool because she's actually a loser. So it doesn't make sense that Barbara is like so looking up to her. And she can't say, oh, I wish I was like Wonder Woman, because Wonder Woman doesn't exist yet. Wonder Woman doesn't actually debut as a public figure until, you know, until the modern times after Superman comes out. So it's like, so there isn't even a culture of worship around Wonder Woman that Kristen Wiig could be a part of. You've seen that character before, and like the Riddler in Batman Forever is like worshipable of Batman and Bruce Wayne. Like you've done this kind of villain before, but they don't really give us anything about Diana to really connect with. And then Wonder Woman is like just a phantom basically in this world. So what is it about Barbara? Why does Barbara want to be like Gal Gadot? And it also doesn't help that like Kristen Wiig has more personality and charm than Gal Gadot. So it's even more confusing. And she's like a bit older than her. So it's just very strange for this older, more mature, better actress to be like so thirsty to become like Gal Gadot.
This also going back to kind of like the like, whoa, like Wonder Woman, you knew Chris Pine for like, what, a week? Like, this is the thing, is they go from like, she bumps into her. She's like, hi, do you want to have lunch? And then within 24 hours, she's like, I wish I was just like you.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, tapping into like a potentially like undiagnosed personality disorder here that isn't being brought up. But everything happens so fast. Like, you can't have like, what, like a montage or maybe like, oh, hey, it's been a week. Do you want to get that lunch? You know, like,
yeah,
this movie goes so fast and it doesn't need to,
and it goes so slow at the same time.
Yes.
It's weird. It's like this year has been, maybe it is the perfect film. Yes. For 2020.
Yeah. So before we close out, let's try to parse the politics of this movie and just, you know, kind of to set the context for it. The first Wonder Woman movie. Now, Wonder Woman as a character traditionally is presented that she debuted as a superhero, possibly during World War II, fighting the Nazis. There's plenty of old Wonder Woman comics where she's fighting the Nazis, you know, red, white, and blue, fighting the Nazis, yada, yada, yada. Captain America, Superman, they all did it, right? For some reason, Wonder Woman 1 decided that even though she would still spend the time fighting the Germans, it would take place during World War I. So you have all this pro-America jingoism along with like this evil Nazi aesthetic, but placed onto World War I, such that if you ask the average person, they will think that Wonder Woman was fighting the Nazis in her first movie. And this confusion where, you know, they're trying to convince people that in World War I, like, America was the good guys and there were clear bad guys and they were the Germans. That was the politics of the first movie that was like pretty shitty and shady, but this one adds lots of new layers to it. Wonder Woman finally directly tackles the politics of the Middle East, and it's quite interesting, I would say. Q, what did you think?
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, okay. I was actually, first of all, I was high as fuck when I was watching the movie last night, right? So a few things might have gotten by me, but I did pick up that, you know, Maxwell Lord goes to somewhere in the Middle East or North Africa because he picked up, Diana and Steve pick up a magazine and they see that, you know, he's gotten tickets to Cairo. And he had also looked at this this magazine that had this, you know, brown dude on the cover. So, you know, they steal a jet from the Smithsonian. And I'm thinking to myself, hang on a second. Now, I may be high as fuck, but why would there be a fully fueled fighter jet sitting in the Smithsonian that they can just like take off with and fly all the way to fucking Cairo? Where did they land?
I've been bothered by this too.
This plane.
Because, all right, I don't. And here's my thing: I have nothing about airplanes, nothing. But I would imagine the technology has jumped like crazy from when Chris Pine was flying a plane. Because I would try to be like,
yes.
I don't know. I know, like a long time ago, he had to like wind up a car to start it. Like, how is he operating this like plane?
He was flying in World War One, he would have been flying he would have been flying an airborne bucket, okay? and he's able to fly a fighter jet across like all of the air currents and temperature changes and all that shit. Hang on. First of all, even taking all of that out of the picture, can a fighter jet go from DC to North Africa? Is that even possible? I'm not even sure, but yeah. I assume that the reason that aircraft carriers exist is because they don't have that kind of a range. They have to sail these jets out to where they can fly from to do their sorties and their bombings and dogfights and whatever.
And even if you're going to take on face value that, all right, Patty Jenkins, she works closely with the military in making her film. She even did a little promo. So I'm sure they got the right jet that could just make it across, you know, the water, make it to Cairo. And I'm sure they got the right jet that would be possible for a World War One fighter pilot to fly. Maybe like all of that is true, but the fact is that the only reason this very, very, very long scene exists in the movie is that Wonder Woman could have an invisible jet that she creates with her brand new power of turning things invisible that we just learned about the second that she does it.
The very second the power is needed, yeah.
And that's the part I freaked out because I'm watching it. And in my head, I'm trying to figure out, could Chris Pine operate this fighter pilot? And the second I was like, oh, they're doing the invisible jet joke. God damn it.
All of that. So much for this bizarre joke. Completely unnecessary. They're like, oh, we need to get to Cairo. But wait, you don't have a passport, Steve, because you're a ghost taking someone else's body. I'm like, wait a minute. That guy probably has a passport.
That guy probably has a passport. Why wouldn't Steve have a passport available? The guy seemed like first of all, he said he was like an engineer or something. Second, this is in DC, right? So like who in like the elite social scene in that city does not have a passport? That was, so to me, the most plausible thing about that entire setup was Wonder Woman that very second being able to turn the fucking jet invisible.
And also, this is like 1984, he's a white guy. They just let them on the planes back then. You just had to, like, if you were a handsome white guy, you just waved to the pilot on the way and you got on. You didn't need fucking identification.
I know. Did they even have like airport metal security scanners back then? Like, I'm pretty sure it was. I forget which bombing it was in particular, but I'm almost positive it was somewhere in the late 1970s to early 1980s where they started doing like the whole securities theater thing before you even get on the plane. So I don't know, that to me was highly implausible on its own. But then when they get there. And Maxwell Lord is having this conversation with, and I was really confused about this because I thought what they were trying to do was like transplant the DC sort of like Middle Eastern country of what is it called, like Bialya or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah, it's like Bialya.
I thought they were trying to do like a veil of Bialya over Egypt and say that, oh, there's some sort of like disputed territory, kind of the way that Marvel Universe does with like Wakanda being in East Africa, like East Southern Africa, but it shares borders with Uganda and Kenya, I'm pretty sure. I thought it was something like that. What it actually was instead was that king of Bialya was living in Cairo in exile and had some oil to sell. Like he owns oil, but he's also in Egypt. I'm like, but this doesn't make no sense. If he's in exile, then he would have no territorial claim to this oil whatsoever. Whatever, like, new nation, like, it's almost like if the KMT was able to like sell goods and resources out of China proper from Taiwan, like that wouldn't make any fucking sense. The CCP would have sovereignty over whatever is within its borders and sell things as they wish. So how could this person in exile have any sort of like hegemonic power over this nation that he's exiled from in the first place? So I took it as, okay, so this country is supposed to be a stand-in for Egypt, and what they've done is give Egypt a king, except that in 1952, Egypt had a revolution where they got rid of their king. So they've basically just taken like a bunch of these Middle Eastern tropes, like these Orientalist tropes that always show up. They basically like did like comic book Syriana, right down to the fucking shitty yellow filter. And like, so when Maxwell Lord is offering this guy his wish and he says, well, what I wish is that I have like my entire kingdom back and we would get rid of all the heathens. And then a wall magically pops up out of nowhere that cuts like people on one side of the wall off from their source of natural water, and people on the other side of the wall like have their kingdom back. And he says, well, in return for that, I'll take your oil. He's like, ha ha ha, I sold all of my oil to the Saudis. I don't no longer own it. He's like, okay, well, I'm just going to take your private security force. And then all of the disruption that occurs from your country being destabilized by this new and sudden territorial dispute, have fun taking care of all that by yourself. And I thought to myself, the actor who's playing this king, Amr Waqed, he was convicted in absentia of spreading untruths about the Egyptian government. Now, the modern, like today's Egyptian government is a fascist, like puppet dictatorship that's propped up by the United States. And one of the benefits that the U.S. gets from Egypt essentially being in its pocket is that Egypt, which was previously a fierce advocate on behalf of the Palestinians and against Israel's sort of hegemonic power in that region, is now able to sell out the Palestinians and convince the Jordans, the Saudis, etc., that they should just allow Israel to continue annexing territories and essentially like offer no protection or secure to the Palestinians whatsoever. So it's like, but there's that sort of shift in like political alignment never crosses the minds of like the broader American public, not in mass media, certainly not in movies. So what this kind of looks like is like a continuity of thought for all these like MENA countries, that they're all backwards puppet dictatorships that are propped up by these like incompetent figures that have no control over the resources, no control over their own people, because all they're interested in is accumulating power and inflicting terror on their own people. And when they like put that over top of Egypt, which has historically been like one of the bulwarks against Western hegemony in the MENA region, I thought that is really fucking egregious. And like, shame on this dude, who I understand why you'd have a problem with the Egyptian government, but like, this is just straight up fucking propaganda. And you're happy to go ahead and play this role because you may have a personal grudge, but what does that do to the broader American conception about what the dynamics of Middle East and North African politics are?
Yeah, it's completely bizarre that the detour that this film takes, because it's not as really like a political movie. Like the core lesson of the movie is like to tell the truth, and like love is fleeting or some shit like that, right? Like, so appreciate the time that you have with your son or your fighter pilot boyfriend or whatever, right? Like, but it has nothing to say, but it still takes this detour to the Middle East and it doesn't stick to just the fake country of Bialya. It does say, you know, Egypt and Cairo, and there's, you know, also the specter of Gal Gadot and her support, her former membership of and support for the IDF as well. And it really comes to a head with the fight scene where you have Gal Gadot versus this, you know, brown security force, right, that she's blowing up and destroying all the jeeps for and shit. I think technically she doesn't kill anybody, or she tries not to, but there's this one scene where Chris Pine takes like a missile and he throws it in the air to fire it off, and Gal Gadot whips onto the missile and then saves two little brown children who are in the road. And people pointed out that this is kind of invoking, you know, when the boys who were killed playing soccer on the beach by the IDF
during Operation Protective Edge, yeah,
which Gal Gadot specifically praised.
Fuck her forever for that. Honestly, like, I didn't like her before. I really didn't. Okay, so if anyone's not familiar, in 2014, Gal Gadot called Hamas cowards. They were supposedly hiding behind women and children, is what she said. She says, especially to all my boys, I'm sending love and prayers to all my fellow Israeli citizens, especially to all the boys and girls who are risking their lives protecting my country against the horrific acts conducted by Hamas, who are hiding like cowards behind women and children. we shall overcome, Shabbat Shalom, we are right, free Gaza from Hamas, stop terror, yada, 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 right? A bunch of hashtags and shit. Now, Operation Protective Edge killed, like, so many people. Like, there was just these indiscriminate drone bombings. Acts of, like, terror committed against Palestinian people. There was, like, human rights atrocities and violations. Like, I think it's clear to any, like, right-thinking individual that Operation Protective Edge was, like, a human atrocity against the Palestinian people. And she was all for it at the time. So in this scene, this chase scene where they're chasing after Maxwell Lord, who now is in possession of the King of Bialya's security force, this convoy is like driving down the road. And this is where I say her powers are sort of fluctuating in and out, because on one hand, she's able to like lasso one of the trucks and like use it to like get towards the other trucks, and she's able to like veer one of them off course by kicking it, and she goes underneath one of the trucks and then like straddles the transaxle with her legs and then pulls it down into the ground, and the axle like pistoning into the ground flips this entire truck over, which launches her into the air so that she can get on top of another truck. So it's like, okay, so her powers are back, are they? But then she ends up sandwiched between two of the trucks, and then one of them like tries to sideswipe the other truck to smash her between them, and she's not able to like leg press the truck away from herself. She's slowly becoming crushed by the truck. So I'm like, okay, are her powers coming or going? I'm not really sure. But as all this is happening, a couple of brown kids are playing soccer on the side of the road, and they kick the ball into the middle of the street. So I'm like, all right, these children on this road, which apparently is like being used by convoys all the time because it was like their path out of the country or towards the airport or wherever they were going, so it has to be like a high traffic road. These kids kick the ball into the middle of the road and then continue playing soccer in the middle of the fucking road, and their mom is standing right there watching them kick the ball into the middle of the road and play soccer, and nobody has any sort of like sense of preservation instinct or like trying to like protect their own children, nothing like that. They continue playing soccer while this convoy is bearing down on them from like a mile and a half away, because like several things happen in the course of this scene between Gal Gadot noticing the children are in the street and then having to save the children. So what happens next is Steve, without any, by the way, no communication between the two whatsoever, like they didn't actually like communicate this plan to save these children, Steve, who is like a couple of truck lengths behind Wonder Woman, fires a missile towards Wonder Woman and also towards these children. Wonder Woman lassos the missile. Now keep in mind, like, it wasn't even a missile. Actually, it was an RPG. It was a rocket-propelled grenade, right? Which only weighs probably like 8, 9, 10, 12 pounds.
Yeah.
Her 125-odd-pound body is carried by this RPG in front of the trucks towards the children. She flings it out of the way with her lasso so that it obviously doesn't hit the children. And then she lassos a power line. Or electricity tower. She lassos it. She gets in front of the trucks. She swoops down. She saves these kids. Except her powers are disappearing again, so she loses control of the lasso, and she falls into the middle of the road. Now, keep in mind, this convoy must have seen the children. If she's able to see the children from behind the convoy, that means whoever's driving in front of the convoy has seen the children and is choosing to bear down on them and run them over regardless, right? But Wonder Woman, having lost control of the lasso and falling in front of the convoy, they see her roll with these children in front of them, and they part ways. They swerve out of the way so that they don't run over Wonder Woman, who, by the way, they were trying to kill for the entire 5 minutes before that. And these children, they swerve out of the way. And then Steve brings his armored personnel carrier that he was driving to a full stop. And I thought to myself, what the fuck just happened here? So these drivers, who either didn't see these children or didn't care, were bearing down on the children. Wonder Woman saves the children, and plausibly, but she saves the children regardless. Wonder Woman, who they were just trying to kill 10 seconds ago, they swerve out of the way to not kill her or to not kill the children. But none of that makes sense. Either they were trying to kill the children and she had to save them, or they were not trying to kill her. The entire reason behind that was to give Gal Gadot a scene saving brown children from these incompetent and murderous brown people. And that was the point where I completely checked the fuck out of the movie.
Oh.
I don't know what more we could say. We haven't even scratched the surface of like the problems with this film, but it's just, we could talk for days about this, but the number one thing I'd have to say, people, is do not watch this movie. There are better movies to watch. Even if you want to watch a movie starring a problematic heroine doing some action, watch Haywire with Gina Carano. Watch The Mandalorian. Watch something else. This movie is not good. It was not worth the wait. I don't know what they were thinking, but it's just a really, truly bad movie, and not bad in an interesting way. And I'm so sorry for anyone who watched it. But on that note, thank you, Q, so much for joining us today. Where can people find you?
So you can find me. My Twitter handle is at Andre Demise, and you can find my writing in McLean's magazine, and you can also listen to the Drop Squad podcast or any of the Resistance Noir podcasts.
All right, folks, that was Struggle Session. Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Bye, everyone.